All right, Relay friends, we are so excited to have you here with author Stephen Lane. He's the author of the book Long Run to Glory. Okay, welcome to the show, Stephen.
Thank you. It is a treat to be here.
It is a treat to co-host this with my friend Peter Bromka. He's going to have much better input in this conversation than me because, as he knows, I like to tell him he is a much bigger running nerd than I am.
Yeah, Lindsay is still trying to define, hide her running nerdiness despite like hundreds of podcasts. And that all came about this spring when we were walking down Newberry Street before the Boston Marathon. She's like, I'm not really a nerd like these people. And I'm like, oh, wow. Okay. Interesting. I'm curious, Stephen, how do you think of yourself in this world of running nerdiness? We use the term affectionately.
I'm a double nerd. I'm a total running nerd, and I'm a history nerd. So a lot of I had to cut whole chapters of like actual history from the book because my editor's like, no, nobody wants to read about 1900s in England and how that relates to the Olympics. So yeah, I embrace nerdiness of all kinds. So.
Okay.
And you teach history.
I do. Yes. Yeah. So that's my outlet for that side. Anyway.
Well, so I want to first for our listeners, so they're not like, why am I listening to this? I want to get to, the headline of what this book is about because it's I very much enjoyed it. But Lindsay and I both did. I am still secretly curious how you came about world history leading to this. So maybe we can get to that in a little bit. But when people ask you, at these holiday parties coming up, like, oh, Stephen, what's your book about? And why should I care?
Well, so it's about the first women's Olympic marathon. And that's obviously it's a seminal event in running history. But I really think it's certainly the greatest marathon in Olympic history, and I think it might be the greatest marathon of all time. Just looking at the competitors, like the women who are in that race are like gods. Like their records are unbelievable. And it's the only time all four, Joni, Greta Weitz, Ingrid Christensen, and Rosa Moda, it's the only time all four raced a marathon against each other. And so I don't know, in boxing, people always talk about the fight of the century, like the greatest heavyweights of all time. Here you had four of the greatest heavyweights of all time on the line in a race of unmatched historical importance. There's been nothing like it, I don't think, in the Olympics. So
that's incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why the Olympic marathon is always exciting. Mm. And it's amazing how that simple dynamic still plays out decades later of like people are like, oh, we're not going to see all these men or women on the same starting line, except for the Olympics because of all the stuff you get into, the business interests, like the personal interests.
The other thing for the women is that they didn't really have much choice. Right. So like we could get now some of the greatest distance runners of the era in the marathon. But if you were a 5K specialist or up, you were running the marathon because you didn't have anything else to run at the Olympics. So it was a really cool matchup of just everybody, I guess. Mm-hmm.
For me, the most poignant moment was in the scene where you're talking about how it's very early on in the Olympic marathon and they're still sort of sorting out their paces. They're almost jogging and they haven't gone very far. And you just say, they had now gone the furthest any woman had run in Olympic history. And it's just like, what?
it just kind of struck me like, okay, they're 6 minutes into the race and no woman has ever gone farther. It's like, and that's a comment I get a lot. It's like, wait, it took until 1984.
That's the wildest thing to me. I'm like, wait, I was born before then. That's wild. I was talking to Peter about this before too. Like, of course, most anybody who's a fan of running in the United States knows who Joan Benoit Samuelson is. Everybody knows who she is. And I know the name Greta Watts. I didn't know the other two, Ingrid and Rose Moda.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Am I saying her name right?
Rosa.
I think I'd heard of Ingrid. But anyway, my point is that I think it's so important that this story is told and the eyes are on all these women because like they changed everything for us. They changed the narrative. They changed what it looked like to compete at that level, at that distance. And so for no reason other than the fact that like, if you're a fan of running, you should be a fan of these women who this book is wrote about. You should read this book, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, as you were like researching and talking to the women that you were able to talk to, obviously you couldn't talk to all of them. Yeah. Like, how did you go about that? Like, and who was easier to get conversation, sit down conversations yeah. with?
Yeah, it's, yeah, I mean, that's, for me writing it, one of the most amazing things was learning more about these women. Because, I remember watching the 84 marathon when it happened, and I knew the name Greta Bites, and in my mind, just the way people had talked about her, she was this like terrifyingly scary, like intimidating figure, like unbeatable, like ice cool person, and so that was who I had in mind when I started writing. And then you know you learn more about her, and she's so shy, and she gets so worked up and so anxious before races, and she's sort of, you know, universally known among that generation as one of the kindest and most gracious runners that you know was doing elite running at that time. And it was so nice to sort of learn about them more as people. Like, does that make sense? And so I for me as a running fan, you also often think of, you sort of put these people on a pedestal and make them almost inhuman. And for me, one of the most gratifying aspects of researching it, and something I hope comes across in the writing, is just how human and normal they were, and how they had to deal with the same kind of concerns and worries that we all do before a big race. And so that, yeah, that was a really, once I started researching it, it became clear in a hurry that that's what I really wanted to focus on. So then you start, you know, if you can ask the people in question, you do. But like, so with Greta Weitz, who passed, you know, I was able to spend a lot of time talking to her husband, Jack.
Aww.
Incredibly open and kind with his time. And then just everyone you interview, like, so what was she like? What was she really like? And you try yeah. to get, you just try to get more and more information about them.
That's hard though, because like everybody wants to say the most positive things ever. You know what I mean? Like, oh, I'm going on record on this. Like, he's yeah. going to write about this.
Yeah, and with Joni, it's like people they just run out of ways to say how tough she was. You know.
Yeah.
Like, oh, she was really tough. Oh, she was really, really, really tough. I'm like, okay, I know, but you know, can you say more? And you know, obviously she was, you know, as tough as they come. But also somebody who got, you know, felt the pressure and got, you know, got stressed out by big races, both before and after. And so it's, you know, her toughness is, it's notable, but then it's also important to recognize that it helped her overcome her own internal doubts about how good she can be.
I thought your unpacking of the toughness around her preparation intertwined with her injury was particularly mm-hmm. interesting. I think the injury proneness of runners in general is something we all go through. And so it's a little too easy to say, just like tough it out, because we know that doesn't really work. And so then, I mean, I found myself the most nervous during the Olympic trials, even though you know it's going to work out all right.
Yeah.
Cause you're just like, and so, yeah, I thought, talk to me about like how you peeled that apart. Cause she needs to be tough, but she also like she's right on the edge of doing some really silly damage to herself.
It felt a little reckless.
Yeah.
Well, it is really interesting, because you have Joni's innate toughness, like, I am doing this no matter what. But, you know, to back up this, you know, into the story, so she hurts her knee maybe, you know, maybe 2+ months before trials or whatever it is. And on doctor's recommendations, she repeatedly defers surgery Even though in her heart, like, she knows her body really well. She knows, like, a couple days off isn't going to solve this. This is bigger than this. And but she finds herself unable to vocalize that to her doctors. And that to me was so interesting. And she writes about that in her memoir, that the fact that she felt like she couldn't challenge her doctor's expertise. And I don't know, like, if you read studies about, you know, about how the healthcare system works and doesn't work, particularly for women, that's a real issue, getting doctors to sort of legitimize what women say about their own condition. And I'm not saying that was, you know, that her doctors, Dr. Leach especially, was that way, but you wonder if somehow she had internalized that growing up, that doctors weren't necessarily going to listen to her. And so there's this incredible toughness, and then there's this deference to the authority of the doctor that she can't overcome. And then when she finally does have surgery, it's almost like she has to disassociate from the fact that she just had surgery. You know, she wakes up, she comes out of surgery, she's like, I need to go running right
ready
now.
Ready to run.
Yeah.
No, you can't do that. Yes, in that case, I think it was reckless, but I think one of her most impressive mental traits is that ability to disassociate. In the Olympic trials itself, at the beginning, it's not going well. She's hurting, and her, you know, her knee and her hamstring, nothing feels right. And she, like, in her brain, she's like, okay, I need to get out of this. And she kind of goes back to, oh, trees, ocean. This is kind of like Maine. I can pretend I'm on a training run. And I just can't help but be overcome by the mental agility to do that in the biggest race of your life. Is, you know, like, if that had happened to me, I just would have spiraled, like, down, like, what's the matter with you? Like, you know, this is big race and you're letting everything go. And she's like, okay, I'm gonna get out of this headspace and go to a comfortable place and get into a rhythm. There's mental toughness, but then there's the ability to think on your feet in the middle of a race and adjust. And I think she doesn't get enough credit for that. I think she does that repeatedly in big races. It's really amazing.
Yeah. And I was thinking too, after I said reckless, I'm like, it depends on what you define as reckless, right? Like, maybe that's reckless for, like, an everyday runner who's trying to break, like, a certain time, but, like, okay, Olympics on the line. Okay. Maybe it doesn't work out and I break my foot or whatever happens. Yeah. Fine. Yeah. Not the end of the world, but I'm going to go for it. I still, though, like, reading the timeline, it's mind boggling that she was able to pull that off at the trials. I mean, it's just like, I feel like in today's day, like, there's just no way someone would be able to pull that off. It's wild.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's a really interesting point. Like, how would a runner today react to that? And nothing against today's runners, but it seems like a different environment. And you know, one other thing I'm always struck by with Joni is how well she felt she knew what was best and what she could do. And sometimes it got her in trouble, but today I think with the support structure around runners, they might have so many other voices in their head saying, you shouldn't do this, it's dangerous, you got a career to think about, skip this race and take a big payday at the next big marathon, whatever it is. Like, Joni, there were fewer of those voices, and Joni had gotten used to not ignoring them, but you know, taking it into consideration and then doing what she thought her body could handle.
I mean, talk about input. I mean, you have input from everybody.
Oh yeah, nowadays. Yeah.
She didn't have to have any of that. And she chose to kind of, like, you know, do this anyway. So, like, stay in her, like, keep her a little bit of a tunnel vision, like, I'm gonna do what I wanna do. But now, like, it's nearly impossible to do that.
Well, it's funny, like, Lindsay runs a successful podcast of bringing people on. And I have often wondered, like, it is good for the promotion of the sport for runners to talk pre-race, but it's always, like, a real curiosity of mine of how much it helps the actual athlete to voice their own story aloud. You know, and that's where, like, the actual pre-race press conference the day before or 2 days before is often like, why are we even here? Like, you're all just telling us these weird lies that you're telling yourself. Like, maybe you don't believe it's a lie. Like, it's just like so many layers. So, I mean, it was fun that I did appreciate the part of how you led us through the building up of it from not a non-existent sport to a professional sport with the, you know, the money flowing into New York City in particular. And then I think there's an element of, I mean, this has happened during my lifetime and I'm still like, this has always been around. Right. So it's like, it was nice to have you walk us through like, no. And here you go. And here you go. And honestly, two threads I think you've touched on nicely were marathoning is a sport and it's intensely competitive, but its foundation is just deep love of running and the runningness. I mean, they're intertwined. And so like, it's easy to say she wants to go out and run because she wants to prepare for the competition. But really, like, you got deep inside the minds of these people. You know, like, sometimes I had to reread sentences. You're like, oh, this woman found herself running 130 miles a week? Like, what? Like, what? And not because she like saw online, you know, in a message board that this is, it's just like very much naturally found herself running twice a day and oops, running for an hour each time. And yeah, I guess it made, so I was curious, like, what was that like for you to go back to the beginning of like women really, it's sort of like women were running and then they were acknowledged as athletes after they'd been doing it. They'd been going through the motion, but not calling it that.
Yeah. No, that's a great way to put it. Like they were running and doing these amazing things, and finally the sport caught up with them in a way, and recognized that, you know, in a way we were all sort of missing out on the amazing feats that they were doing, and missing out on the chance to be inspired by what they were doing. And I think because there was less, you know, there's less out there. There in terms of here's how you train, here's what you do. Maybe there's a little less structure, so they were kind of doing what felt right, you know, for their bodies. And I think it, you know, it's really interesting to me that so Greta and Joni both at different times contemplated retiring from competitive sport. Like, they didn't need that, but they needed to run, and they would keep running and doing all this stuff, all, you know, no matter what, because, you know, that's what they did. And then the competitive preparing for the race and all that was sort of secondary. And I think there was a lot of that it was a little more individualistic and independent. In good ways. And I both when I was running and when I was coaching, I always felt a little bit of that, like you get wedded to the structure of, oh, we have to do this, we have to do this, and it's really so necessary to like step back and say, okay, we could do that, but how do I feel today, and what do we really need today? And if you need to just go be in the woods for an hour and then forget about like, okay, this is a tempo run, or I'm doing partly like it. Just, I think that's like, that's so valuable to us all, but it's so hard not to get caught up in the structure of the plan, I think. And so maybe the tyranny of the plan has gotten a little more intense over the years. So
yeah, the sense of obligation to do it one way. Another person I wanted to highlight, I really like, there is a moment when you're telling Bobby Gibbs' story, which is remarkable. And then there's sort of this, I had never read about this, despite the uproar and despite the backlash to her, like crashing the race, there seems to be a moment of, peer to peer respect between Jock Semple, the race director, who, you know, is like famously like, I need women to get off my course, to then saying, oh, these women really are runners and they really do love this thing as much as I love this thing. I'm just curious what that was like to revisit.
Yeah, Jock Semple is so complicated, and I don't in any way want to condone, you know, the act that he's probably most well known for, which is trying to tackle Catherine Switzer, the year after Bobby Gibb ran, but you know, Jock Semple had very strong views about what, you know, what the race was for, and it the marathon was truly a sacred event to him, and if he felt you were approaching it with a almost like with an unclean spirit, like he was going to come down on you however he could. And so I think, you know, the difference between how he responded to Bobby Gibb, which was with respect for how she felt about the marathon, which was she had kind of a similar, almost sacred feeling about the marathon. And what he thought Catherine Switzer was trying to do is he thought Catherine Switzer was trying to make some kind of political statement or make a spectacle of his race. And that, I think, you know, injured him personally. He took that personally in a lot of ways. And so he felt Catherine Switzer had cheated and needed to take her number. And because he was hot tempered and tended to strike out violently at anybody, dogs even sometimes, he attacked Catherine Switzer. But if he understood that you took running seriously and respected the races and were running for the right reasons, he fully supported you. And so he and Bobby Gibb came to that understanding pretty quickly, that they both found something really spiritual in the Boston Marathon. And he did get there with Catherine Switzer eventually.
Yes. Like when you wrote about that, yeah, that actually, like, we were actually talking about him on the Relay podcast because Tracksmith posted this picture about saying this isn't a jogger's race, about Boston, and it was this big uproar, and they used the picture of Jock assaulting Catherine Switzer. And I said to everybody, I don't remember if it was a call or a recording, but anyway, I was like, you know, actually reading this book, Long Run to Glory, because all I knew of him was basically the picture and what he did to Catherine. And I learned more about who he was and what he cared about, and not just that he didn't want women running his race officially. And so, yeah, I don't know. It kind of opened my mind about the kind of person he was. So I appreciated that, because I think we oftentimes get one picture, one scenario of a person, and that is what we stick like glue to about who they are. And so you kind of open that door to, like, hey, what he did to Catherine was totally wrong, obviously.
Yeah.
But there are other parts of him that we don't know about. And I like that. I appreciated that.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Well, Peter, I don't know what your memory is of New England area track officials. I don't know where you didn't grow up in New England, but the officials we have are just famously foul tempered, and yeah, they're wonderful and they do great work, but they also, man, you get out of line, they are going to yell at you. And I feel like they're like a generation gentler than Jock was in how they interact with people who are doing what they think is wrong for the sport. And so I have a lot of sympathy for Jock as how he's come down in history. And I, you know, you look at how much he gave to the sport and how much of his time he volunteered. In many ways, you know, so many races in New England wouldn't be what they are without him. And so I did want to get across that, you know, that his love for the sport and his love for running was genuine and true and sort of became the core of his life. Cause I think for a lot of us, that resonates.
That idea of that it's at its core, we're all runners and we love this thing. And like that love of the act to me carries the day. And so it's this, you know, the controversy, I mean, totally inappropriate behavior, how history is remembered. But this idea that the early chapters are very much, you know, will they let women run an Olympic marathon? And, you know, in a modern mindset, you're like, well, duh, like, why not? And then, so you're like, okay, they're making the logical case why it should be allowed. And then I really appreciated that you illuminated how, you know, there's competitive pressure, the world championship, the Olympics don't want to kind of like lose the, you know, the spotlight, but also this idea that I think on a human level, men were forced to see like, oh, this running that women are doing is not just some like side gag. Like they actually love this thing as much as we love this thing. And therefore maybe we should let them do it, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I'm curious though, like, because you wrote about, I finished the book way a long time ago compared to Peter. So everything's not quite as fresh with me. But you wrote about, like, at some point, him and Catherine, Jock and Catherine, would, like, do race promotions together and mm-hmm. things like that. So I'm curious, in your talks with her, they ended up good. Like, they ended up fine, or is that, or not? Or were they just doing that for show because of the marketing?
No, they did. And so one striking thing, and I didn't get this across the way I wanted to in the book, but 1972 is the first year that women are officially allowed to run Boston Marathon. Mm. And Catherine's there. Catherine Switzer's there, and she runs. And that got her thinking a little bit about what her altercation with Jock was, which happened in 1967. And she writes a letter to Jock. Apologizing is the wrong word, because she didn't have anything to apologize for, but explaining that she in no way intended to create a spectacle, that she was there because she loved running, and hearing the stories from her coach up in Syracuse had so inspired her and enthralled her that she really wanted to be a part of Boston, and that's why she did it. And so that she says that's why she ran in 1967. And the much less famous moment, but I think kind of more touching, where he comes up and gives her a hug and puts a kiss on her cheek at the 1973 Boston Marathon. And I think that was the important moment. And you know, Jock being Jock, he's never gonna, you know, out and out apologize, but that was his way of saying that he had been wrong, and that she was just as much a member of the tribe as he was. And that was genuine. You know, that I think that reconnection was genuine, and she'll say as much. And she is so savvy, even today, like how she thinks about, you know, how the sport should be promoted and who, you know, who needs to be involved. It's like talking to her is a real education anytime. So she did recognize the promotional benefit of bringing Jock in when she's organizing her own marathons. And I think the line she uses is the, you know, here's the man who's done more for women's running than anyone, even if unintentionally. And she introduces Jock Semple, and it, you know, it's true. Like those pictures, man, they Ooh. Told a story.
They Iconic.
Really, yeah. Yeah.
You're right though. I mean, I had known, you know, the events that Catherine had done before. I've had her on my podcast before, which was like at the time when I had her on my podcast, it was probably like the biggest deal guest I'd ever had on. It was so cool. Wow. I think it was maybe like 2018 or something like that. And I read her book and everything. But yeah, the things that she was doing in marketing for these races and connecting with Avon, and like, it almost seems like she is the trailblazer. Like she is the one who created what sponsorship for marathons and things like that even look like. And she kind of just made it up. She just did it.
Yeah. She showed what the, like, I think there had been a reluctance to market to women as athletes as well as women. Like, and she showed you could marry the two. And, you know, by that, I mean, she showed that Avon could sell a beauty standard and athleticism in the same event with the same people. And it would really connect with what women want. Yeah, just the way she was able to articulate that as a vision and then execute it, like make it reality, is like, just amazing, just incredible. And you know, her ability to do that, I think, went a long way toward convincing the IOC that they needed to get the women's marathon into the Olympics. So she's really bright.
That's really cool. Yeah. Digging back into the history of those original races make you think at all about how the sport is presented in modern day? I was, you know, just finishing recently, so reading about the trials and, you know, just how the community came together and the thousands of volunteers and all of these local sponsors. And I'm thinking about, okay, Orlando's coming up, and I'm not sure how many people in Orlando are even going to know that it's happening on that February morning. And I'm like, it's a different world in terms of media. It's a different world in how many sports there are. You know, thankfully women can do so many sports now that it's not just like just a few, but like, did it make you think, oh, we should market the sport in this way or that? Or like,
oh man, you know, that's a hell of a question. And I don't have a perfect answer, except sports generally resonates when there's a narrative, when there's a story that people can grab onto and feel. And running in total had that for sure in the 70s and 80s, and women's running especially, right? It was this, you know, it was sort of like all the ideals of the feminist movement of that era, like in motion, right? As a sort of physical representation of all that. And so that it really connected with people in profound ways. And now in some ways it's almost like running is a victim of its own success. It's like, you know, we have these massive races and so many people are doing it. And the fact that I'm not 100% sure of this, but I think at every distance except the marathon, the majority of participants in races are women. It's like, it's close, but it's just, you know, but I think that's right. I should look that up. It's definitely way
don't
more.
Don't cite us here.
Yeah.
So now, like, what does the Orlando trials mean outside of our, you know, our little running? I mean, I guess it's a big running bubble, but it's, you know, it's a little bit of our, you know, outside of our tribe. What does it mean? And I don't know. I've been in touch with the folks who are organizing it, like the local organizing committee, and they're doing a lot of what the organizers, the Olympia trials did, the first women's trials. You know, there's a lot of volunteer work. There's a lot of community. They're trying to, you know, build a lot of community sort of grassroots excitement for it. And I don't know. The trials is such a cool event. Like, I just feel like, you know, if you can get people to watch it and appreciate it, they'll just come away so impressed by everything. You know, you've got the people who are gunning for a spot on the team, but then you've got the people who are like just being there is their, like, that's their Olympic gold medal, to be on the starting line for the trials. And you know, you see people who've, you know, devoted their life to getting to the trials, and they're there, and they're, you know, outside of their friends and family, like, no one knows who they are, but it doesn't matter. It still means like everything. And it's such an incredible feeling. I don't know, like the trials marathon is just one of my favorite events. And so I hope that people will connect with it and get this sense of what it's all about. I don't know.
You're killing me. You're killing me over here.
Do you know Peter's story, Stephen?
Oh no. Uh-oh. I do.
Well, I really appreciated this book because, I mean, yeah, we're probably cut from similar cloth. We've never met. In the previous Olympic cycle, I tried multiple times to qualify for the Olympic Trials Marathon in Atlanta. Uh-huh. 4 years ago this weekend, coming within 2 seconds of qualifying.
Oh,
and
my God.
I have written about it. And there's this thing where, like, anything you go deep into, you sometimes get so deep into it where you think, am I crazy? Like, why? Like, have I fully exceeded, like, the runway of this dream? And, like, have I lost the script? And have I gone, like, why the hell do I give a shit about this thing so much? And then I was reading your book and I'm like almost in tears. I'm like, motherfucker, that's exactly why. I'm like, because it is this day where the whole nation and we think of ourselves pretty highly in America. Like the whole nation comes together and says, like, this is the most important foot race in the nation, in the country today. Mm-hmm. And it only happens every 4 years. And I was like, yep, there it is. That's exactly why I like dedicated those years of my life to this thing that, like, you're saying, like, not going to have a chance to qualify for the Olympics. Like, it's all going to be over. And oftentimes you hear from people who participate, you know, you highlight some of these women who are like just happy to get there because they're like, oh, this means something to me. And, you know, they're at different points in their athletic journey. And so you're really, again, paying off that tip of the spear competition, but also the love of the event and what it means for the community. And so I was like, wow, I've never read someone else wax poetic about this thing that I adore so much.
Oh, well, thank you. And all right. So if you missed by 2 seconds, that makes you like what, the 200th best marathon, something like
that. I mean, there's some, like, I'm like, well, at least there's a list of the guys, you know, who are faster than me. Whereas usually it's like so ambiguous. I'm like, well, now we have a list. There we are.
Exactly who they are.
Yeah, well, exactly.
I will, it's not quite comparable, but okay. So writing, like, same amount of blood, sweat, and tears, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm like 80,000th on Amazon's bestseller list. So.
Yeah.
You're a way better runner than.
No. Wait, so tell me about this. I read on the Morning Shakeout that you're already in your second reprinting, and that's happening. Like, what's that look like?
Yeah, that's really good news. I think it was a pretty small first run. I think my publisher didn't see its chance for success in the same positive light I maybe did. So I don't think they finished many in the first run as I might have hoped. But yeah, we sold out it really quickly. So that's fantastic.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Which is to say, all right, so when publishers say they've sold out of the first run, that means all the books they have in their warehouse are at retailers. That doesn't mean like retailers don't have them. It just means that when we're hoping to print more by February, so if retailers run out, but they should be stocked for.
Well, we're definitely recommending it to our Relay community as, like, you know, if you listen to Relay, you're enough of a running nerd affectionately to go and dive into that backstory. I'm curious it's been out a few months, like, mm-hmm. and you said, I read in your interview that you've received kind notes from some of the women who are highlighted in the book. Yeah. Any other stories that have sort of like caught you off guard or trickled back to you in a pleasant way?
Yeah, you know, it's like, obviously, you know, there are probably people who hated it or stopped reading it after 30 pages, and they tend not to write back. They tend not to reject you. So
don't worry about
it. I'm sure there are lots of those out there too, but I have been very gratified by the way people have responded, and some of the neatest things have been from non-runners that. Mm. You guys probably feel the same way. Like, I feel like our sport is so awesome, and it can mean so many things to so many different people that I'm just like, if anybody like just devotes a little bit of their attention to the sport, like they're going to feel something profound. And so in writing this, part of what I was thinking about is, okay, if I can get like a casual sports fan or somebody like who's just a history buff or something to read this and maybe be like, wow. Running is, you know, it's maybe everybody says it's about their sport, but I'm always, it's more than a sport. You know, for most of us, it means something bigger than that. And so if I can get non-runners to feel that, I think that's a great goal. And from some of my non-running friends or, you know, or friends of theirs, or even just one guy kind of emailed me out of the blue. I think he got my email off the school website and was like, I just wanted to tell you this is really a powerful book. I'm like, thanks.
How do non-runners even find it if they're not like in your sphere of people that you know?
I don't know.
People that are just into sports and they find it in like the sports section or something. Yeah. No, I was just going to say, as a female runner, I'm just like blown away by these women that this story is mostly about, honestly. And I said to Peter earlier, like, where would we be right now had all of that not taken place? Would it have just taken place 4 years later? Like, who would have eventually been those people to break down those barriers, you know?
Yeah, it's really it's really interesting to think about. And you know, so like Joan Benoit, when she's being interviewed, it's like not even 5 minutes after the marathon. She makes a point of thanking the earlier generation, like the, you know, Bobby Gibb and Jackie Hansons and Catherine Switzers of the world, you know, say we wouldn't be here without them. But yeah, you wonder like what would have happened if, you know, if they hadn't been there, or if, you know, if Greta Weitz hadn't broken the world record 3 times in a row in New York. Like what if she had broken the world record at the Oslo Marathon, and you know, there's like, you know, like 10% of the media attention she gets in New York is seeing it. Like is there the same snowball effect, or are we waiting 4 years down the road, or even 8 years? It's I don't know. The women who did it were just uniformly just really impressive, really, really inspirational figures. So.
Yeah, there's some really great personalities to dive into, and I think we often talk about how the marathon can be thought of as like the longest competitive distance in track and field, but it really is, it's different. It's the event that, you know, regular people see on the streets and then go do on the streets. And so sometimes we talk about like running is huge and why is track and field not bigger? But you're like, well, no, like these things, when you're able to walk out your front door and see like these inspiring people pass by, it just, and then you're able to run down that same street. It's just different than, you know, at one point you mentioned that Joni might, if she can't get her knee in order, like go run the 3K. And you're like, oh no, like this is not the same.
No, it's not. And it's like the, you know, it's the only race that it's got a name instead of a distance. And it's, you know, and it goes back to the, you know, this sort of mythical Greek hero thing that yeah, it's just got more of a backstory than, hey, let's go run, you know, a mile or 1500 meters or 3000 meters. And it's something, you know, I think we recognize this isn't quite true, but we have in our mind that it's not just talent. It's not just you're the fastest person. You have to be the, you know, the toughest, the most willing to endure. And that's certainly part of it. But and so it maybe it resonates. It feels like it connects more to our experience in a way. Like, you know, like I love, believe me, I love the mile. I love the five, but they just seem like physically aliens. It's like I don't understand how anybody can run that fast.
Listen, guys, I feel like I'm the least running dork of this group. I'm just saying. I'm just saying.
As long as it makes you feel good.
Oh man. Okay, so we got to wrap up here. Any last thoughts? Peter, do you have any last thoughts on?
I would just say, like, maybe the obvious truth that if you're a running geek like us, this is the richness in the history of why we're seeing what we're seeing today. And maybe it's just like the obvious truth that women's history isn't just for women, that, you know, that it is an integral part to what we're witnessing today. So I encourage everyone to dive in. And I'm happy that Stephen cut the maybe like five preamble chapters about the Industrial Revolution. But so like he really gets you into it, and you're like, you should show, trust us, it's worth your time.
Well, no, I really appreciate you guys having me on the show, and I, you know, if I'm going to plug my own book, I just say the women in that kind of form the basis of the story, for, you know, from Bobby Gibb up through the women who contested the medals at 84 are just, it doesn't matter who you are, they're just so inspirational. They're such amazing people that I think it's worth picking up for that. So,
Yeah, thank you for all your work on this.
all right, well, thank you.